This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Tell our listeners real quick, what do you guys do? What's your game?
So, we're a two-person shop.
Do you also have the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost on your side?
We hope so.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, the January Jones of the Education Reform Movement, Stephanie Sirocki.
Yay! Hi, Mike.
Hi, Stephanie. That's a joke. You know, we don't do video, so people, don't worry. Stephanie is not wearing a bright red dress that's basically suspenders for women, as Amber quipped. Do you know anything that you're talking about? Do you know
Thankfully.
Who January Jones is?
I hear she's involved with Mad Men.
Yes.
Okay. Mm. I don't know if you've talked about Mad Men much, but you're apparently very obsessed with them.
Well, some of the listeners may know that my wife and I, we are going back and watching all the Mad Men reruns, and it's an excellent show. You've got to check it out.
I'm happy you have time for that.
Well, just barely. This is what's big news, is that finally, after like 3 years of no pop culture, this is all the pop culture I've got. All right, so Stephanie from the Seton Education Partners, she happens to work on the seventh floor of our building.
She's, we call it the dungeon.
The dungeon. We are helping in a small way to help incubate this group. Tell our listeners real quick, what do you guys do? What's your game?
So, we're a two-person shop, me here in D.C. and Scott Hamilton out in San Francisco.
But you also have the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost on your side.
We hope so. Sometimes we wonder, but we are really crossing our fingers that that's the case. We're trying to save urban Catholic schools in America. They are going away, and they are going away rapidly, and there are not enough people in education reform who are paying attention.
All right, good. Well, we're going to talk about that a little bit more in a minute. So thanks for having us here. Rick is gone this week. I believe he's finally back from a sojourn next week, perhaps. We look forward to you coming back, Rick. We miss you. All right, lots to cover. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. We'll hear Amber's Research Minute and Chris's What's Up With That? Daniela, get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
So on that exact note, Stephanie, the New York Diocese, Archdiocese, recently announced the closure of 27 Catholic schools in the Gotham area. Why is this such a big deal?
Ah, it's a big deal because it means about 4,000 kids no longer have a strong place to go to school. And it's especially a big deal for the many of those children who are poor and whose only good option or whose only option is a failing district school.
All right, let me play devil's advocate here, Stephanie.
Okay, play it.
Devil's advocate, no pun intended, I guess. So a lot of people would say, look, we don't necessarily know that these schools are all that good anyway. And in fact, I mean, we don't have good student achievement data. While Catholic schools have a long history.
There's very good data on graduation rates, especially for underserved kids.
Okay. All right. So graduation. But we don't know math and reading scores. Some people say, look, if these kids, you know, if we end up taking those buildings, the Catholic schools close and we use them for high quality charter schools instead, which there are a number of in New York City, then maybe you're even better off.
So it's a good question. I would love to see some of those empty buildings, if they're closed, being used for high quality charter schools. If you think about the cost of building a new charter school, let's say $500,000 in a place like New York City, and you look at the cost of keeping an existing Catholic school that's serving kids well open, Catholic schools are educating underserved kids at half the cost of a district school or of a charter school. You're getting a much stronger bang for your buck if you continue to invest in the Catholic school.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is keeping people away from this? I mean, why don't we hear more about this in the education reform world? Is it that a lot of the reformers these days are kind of left of center reformers? They tend to support charter schools, but not necessarily school choice. Is it a church state thing? Is it an accountability thing? What is it?
I think that that the private faith-based side of education is very separated and segregated from the public side of education. And it's unfortunate because parents don't care if the school is a district school or a charter school or a faith-based school. They just want their kids to go to a great school. And so should we.
Okay, great. Topic number two.
Topic number two, then. Miami-Dade School District is partnering with Florida Virtual to offer courses taught at school, but through e-learning labs. Is this just a fancy way to beat the class size mandates in Florida, or is it a sign of things to come on the virtual sector?
Well, this is fascinating to me because the class size mandates in Florida are a big problem. I mean, you know, these are constitutionally required class sizes. They've been instituted by a vote of the population. They went back to try to change them, and the population again said, no, we want that in place. But there's no money to pay for it. So, you know, people are going to, I'm sure a lot of people in the education establishment are going to say, oh, this is horrible. These kids learning online. We need qualified teachers right there in the classroom. But look, I mean, you know, times are tough financially and you have to make some choices. So if you want to have small classes, then this sounds like a reasonable solution to make sure that while kids are not in those tiny classes, they're spending part of their day online learning. Sounds like a reasonable solution to me.
I think it's all going to depend on how they implement these learning labs. Some of them are going to be good. Some of them aren't going to be so good.
Right. Now, aren't you guys looking at Seton at online learning as a possible solution for Catholic schools?
Yes, we're actually learning at we are one of our initiatives is taking technology to restructure the school day and how we use teachers so that we can reduce operating costs at a school, but to do it in a way that both maintains good relationships with adults, so that you have both a high-tech and high-touch environment. And I think that's key.
I mean, look, nobody wants their kids in front of a computer all day for their own child. And people shouldn't want that for other people's kids, you know, but to spend part of the school day learning online so that the rest of the day perhaps can be richer, can have, you know, higher quality teachers, can have smaller class sizes, all those sorts of things. Seems like it makes a lot of sense. And particularly because, you know, some kids are going to learn the content better online than they would sit in a classroom with one teacher and a bunch of kids around them.
And I think the technology these days is so much better than it was in the past. And so I definitely see this as, and I see it only getting better in the future.
So I don't say this very often, but kudos, Miami-Dade. Kudos. All right, topic number three.
Okay, last question. Tucson's Mexican-American Studies course has recently been banned under Arizona's new controversial ethnic studies law. Is Arizona being xenophobic? Or do programs like this do little more than promote a divisive culture and constructed identity politics?
Stephanie.
Wow.
Whoa. What do you think about this one, huh?
We're going hard-hitting on the last one.
That is very hard-hitting. You know, let me say that.
You know, Stephanie grew up in South San Diego.
Chula Vista. Yeah. We were 5 minutes from Tijuana.
Yeah.
And I'm actually going to be marrying in 2 months a Latino. And we actually talked about this article and actually this issue. Both of us want to raise our children to know their culture and to know their to know their history. We also want them to know American history and American ideals. And it's not clear that this course is filling the gaps that I'm sure many American history courses have, or if it's propaganda.
So what this is all about is that Tucson has this Mexican-American studies program. It's been in place for a while. And the concern is that instead of teaching U.S. history broadly, that they are teaching Mexican-American history to Mexican-Americans. Now, it's hard to know from afar exactly what's in the course and what it's all about. And, you know, from what I can tell, I think there are some reasons to be concerned. I mean, look, we should have a policy that says all American kids should learn U.S. history, and that history should be about all Americans. And of course, we should teach about everything that's happened in this country, including the not so happy stories and about oppression and about certain groups being discriminated against. But to say that we should teach, you know, Mexican American history to Mexican Americans and African American history to African American, I mean, that starts to get really scary. And, you know, we need to make sure we have the whole E Pluribus Unum ideal up front and center. Now, the New York Times has pitched this on its editorial page as another example of Arizona, you know, being anti-immigrant. And I think that that's a little unfair. I mean, I understand that there's that risk and that some politicians, you know, see this as an opportunity to you know, bang their anti-immigrant drum. So that's understandable. But I think there's plenty, you know, this happens all over the country in certain liberal communities that they've got these kinds of studies programs. And I think it's reasonable to question them.
I think this is actually what's nice about this is that America actually cares about what kids are learning in terms of history. And that makes me pretty happy.
Now, you went to school at Berkeley, did you call it? At the Berkeley University of California?
UC Berkeley. I definitely took ethnic studies courses. In fact, I think that meant that at least one is a requirement for graduation. I could be wrong. And so it's our colleges have definitely started have a lot more of these courses, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure that they're appropriate at the high school level.
You know, there's a book that's on my shelf that I need to read called Are Italians White? And it's about the history of, you know, how Italians were seen, my people, and that, you know, there was a time when we were seen as other and as, you know, an ethnic group of, you know, and now we kind of just mix right in and there's, you know, Italians on the Supreme Court and whatever. And the question is, you know, the immigrant groups over time have always said, look, we want to learn English. We want to be Americanized. We want to, you know, and you have, you know, more of the, you know, now academy saying, oh, no, we got to make sure that we maintain the separate racial and ethnic identities. It's just interesting to see how these things play out. And my own concern is that if we go too far to the point of maintaining sort of racial, ethnic identity, that does slow down the assimilation that over time is good for the newcomers, is good for the country. That's where I stand. Okay, Daniela, nicely done.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for playing. It's now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
How you doing?
Well, did you enjoy
Amber,
your long
looking
weekend?
Amber, you're looking lovely.
I did. Why, thank you. Yes, I did. Went to see The King's Speech.
Oh.
Good movie, if you hadn't seen it yet.
Yeah.
Quite a good movie. I think Colin Firth, I heard, won the Golden Globe the other night, although I didn't watch it, but he gave a great performance.
This is the third year in a row that I'm going into an Oscar season having seen none of the movies. So I'll put it on my list
yes,
for Netflix.
Yes, worthwhile.
Okay. Yeah, by the way, it's okay to plug Netflix on the show, you know, because Reed Hastings, the founder
has
of
he given
Netflix,
you money, by the way?
He has not given us money, but
he's a good guy.
We're now like David Letterman trying to get Oprah on his show with this.
But if you're listening out there, Reed, we just want to give a shout out to you by your excellent work in education reform over the years.
Is Reed one of the 2,000 listeners to the podcast?
You never know, Stephanie. You never
know. We're hoping.
We have some very esteemed listeners out there. I don't want to name names, but look, the lights light up over at 400 Maryland Avenue.
You know, Whitney Tilson came out with a bet against Netflix, and apparently it's been their worst investment.
Mm. I saw that. Yeah.
Yikes.
Okay. Amber, what
anyway,
you got for us
on
this
to
week?
Research. New study out this week by Dan Goldhaber and Roddy Theobald. Hope I'm saying that right. They examine the extent to which teacher effectiveness play a part in layoff decisions in Washington State. So they examine layoff data for over 2,000 regular classroom teachers in the 08-09 and 09-10 school years to determine how layoffs actually played out. Then this was kind of interesting. They conduct a simulation to determine how those layoffs would look if officials had actually used an effectiveness-based layoff scenario. In short, they find that seniority is the greatest predictor for a teacher receiving a layoff notice. No big surprise there. Approximately 80% of teachers receiving a layoff notice had two or few years of seniority in their current district. So, last hired, first fired is alive and well, though there was limited evidence that teachers were protecting those teachers in high-need areas such as math and science. In addition, 36% of those teachers who actually received layoff notices were estimated to be more effective than the average teacher who did not. And the current layoff policy could lead to students losing 2 to 4 months of learning in the year after the layoffs. Finally, they end basically saying that if you used an effectiveness-based policy, it would result in 10% fewer layoffs. Since a seniority-based system means that you would have to basically fire more teachers. So anyway, useful study.
So I got to hear Dan present on mm-hmm. the study.
Yeah, and why wasn't I invited
I
to
know,
that?
Amber, just I should have brought you along.
As a side note,
I know.
Anywho.
It was at a very nice restaurant yeah. in downtown Washington.
I was invited to the Matt Chingos roundtable, but not the Dan Goldhaber.
You need to give Dan a hard time
Rick
about that.
Wasn't around either. I'm hoping he would have figured that one out. Anywho.
So. All right. Well, do I know? I'll try to make that one
I digress.
So, to me, the most interesting finding was that there was very little overlap between the group of teachers that did get laid off, or at least layoff notices, mm-hmm. and the group of teachers who would have gotten laid off using effectiveness. Only something like 16%.
Less than 20%.
Yeah. So which means that, because you would think that, you know, even if you went on effectiveness, you'd still have a lot of the young teachers laid off because they're new and they're not as effective yet. But it turns out that actually, 84% of the ineffective teachers have more than 2 years experience. Yeah.
That is frightening.
And part of this is because it's still at the very end of the tail. I mean, we're talking about very few teachers getting laid off in the years that they were looking at in Washington State. Right. And so, if you need to come up with a list of the very worst teachers, those very worst teachers, it turns out, are, by and large, teachers who have burned out were faded away.
And did you catch that they didn't really lose their jobs in the end? They actually were, most of them were hired back because they basically had overestimated what they would need to cut for the, I guess the stimulus funds came in to save the day. So,
right. So these teachers were not actually laid off by and large. Now, there's been lots of critique of this study and in discussion. Some of it is to say, you know, first of all, we all know that there's problems with value added and that it's not a perfect measure and that you might end up laying off the wrong teachers because of some measurement error. Mm-hmm. You also suspect that in the real world, they wouldn't just use value added measurement. Mm-hmm. They'd use other factors as well. You know, the degree to that student achievement would be boosted or you'd save money would probably be less than what they, were able to simulate because, this is sort of best conditions when you're able to just make the decisions based on test scores alone.
Right. But I don't know if you caught it, and I didn't read the entire technical paper, but they supposedly did like four different value added way. You know what I mean? They just didn't do one way because there's all these different theories of value added, but they did find that every different way that they manipulated the value added metric, they came up with basically the same findings.
Stephanie, when Catholic schools have to lay off teachers, do you have any idea how they're doing it? Do we have any reason to believe that they're not just doing seniority in Catholic schools either?
Well, it's interesting. The Archdiocese of New York is one of the few Catholic systems that has a teacher union. Mm-hmm. And so I do believe, if I'm not mistaken, that at the Archdiocese of New York, there are union rules. Mm-hmm. But I don't have any information about most of the other Catholic systems that don't have teacher unions and that I don't believe work with seniority.
Hmm. It's interesting, too. If you're protecting the older teachers in the Catholic schools, those are nuns. I guess that's to protect the 75-year-old nun from getting laid off.
Let's just say this. A lot of the teachers at Catholic schools are the younger teachers because the pay differential is much smaller if you look at your first 3 years. Mm-hmm. A teacher at a Catholic school is getting paid almost as much as a teacher at a district school. After 3 years, there's a bigger jump, generally speaking. And that's when it becomes tough for Catholic schools to keep their teachers.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Hey, one more point. You know, Dan Goldhaber on the show all the time in terms of these research studies. I think when Rick Hess does his next influence index of academics, there needs to be an indicator about how often you're on the Education Gadfly show.
Great idea.
Don't you think so? Dan and Tom Kane would shoot
at the top.
Boom, right to the top. All right. What song do we have for today?
It's a tad bit morbid, but since we're talking about less experienced, often younger teachers losing their jobs before the more senior ones, we have Only the Good Die Young by Billy Joel.
Yes. Come out, Virginia. Don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. All the sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. Well, only the good die young. That's what I said. Only the good die. Wow, that was much better. Stephanie, you don't understand that in the last couple of weeks, Amber and our producer Joe have really struggled to find songs that link up with the topic. So that was not only relevant, it was also Billy Joel, which is awesome, and it's a song about Catholicism, linking in with the themes that we've talked about here today. Boom.
You continue to impress me.
I know. You know, Stephanie, for the record, was against the Education Gadfly show when we started.
I wasn't against the show. It was more the tone.
Well, I think almost 4 years on the air just shows you that our tone is just fine. Thank you very much. Okay.
Congratulations.
It is now time for Chris's favorite, What's Up With That? I woke up this morning and I got out of bed, had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that?
There is no denying that some ideas are so brilliant they just can't wait to be implemented. Just ask Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, who both found it more prudent to drop out of Harvard in the name of entrepreneurship. Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal, recently said that our world needs more breakthrough technologies, from Facebook to SpaceX to Halcyon Molecular. Some of the world's most transformational technologies were created by people who stopped out of school because they had ideas that couldn't wait until graduation. Enter the 20 Under 20 Fellowship, devised by the Thiel Foundation as a result, that will award 20 people under 20 years old cash grants of $100,000 to further their innovative scientific and technical ideas. That's right. 20 teenagers will be lucky enough to stop out of school for 2 years to pursue their technological brainstorms. Stopping out of school sure sounds an awful lot better than dropping out, doesn't it? Alas, for every Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg dropout success stories, there are a countless number of individuals whose names or ideas will never be known by the greater public. I'd hate to be on the committee responsible with selecting these 20 people under 20, knowing that awarding these short-term grants will much more likely pull recipients into a downward spiral than propel them to the top of Silicon Valley. The Thiel Foundation is making a big mistake by simply rewarding the best 20 ideas as opposed to only those with true potential. In a time when a bachelor's degree is essential as mere high school diploma once was, I can't really agree that Thiel is doing these students a favor. Awarding students grants for dropping out of school? What's up with that?
Stephanie, what's your take? What do you think? Are we right? Is Chris right to be worried about these 20 young people?
No.
The death spiral into unsuccessful life. Why
no.
not?
They're probably highly motivated, creative young people. And if they're going to get $100,000, if they fail, they'll go to college. Mm-hmm. They'll do plan B.
Yeah, exactly. Look, I mean, what Chris doesn't seem to understand here is that we're all going to be living until we're 100, at least, right? I mean, there's no reason to rush through things. Take your time. Pace it out. Don't go to college when you're 18. Fine. You got plenty of time. Though I will add, there are some areas where you do need to kind of get the ball
moving. I actually think, yeah, sorry, but I actually think some young people would do much better to take a year.
Yeah.
Before they go to college, because they're actually not ready. They're not mature
right.
enough.
And think how much more fun college would be if you already were like a millionaire going into it. I mean, you could really...
You would be the man.
I mean...
Or the woman.
Be drinking good beer instead of that crappy beer that you end up having at fraternity parties, you know? If you were in a fraternity, you could like afford to hire
to
awesome
party.
Bands for your parties. I'm just saying, there would be benefits to this. All right. Well, what is up with that? I have to say, though, at least Chris, I feel like he brought it home. Again, the last couple of times, it was a little bit on the depressing side. This one, a little lighter. Thank you, Chris.
I like Peter Thiel, by the way.
Yeah.
Really interesting to listen to anytime I've listened to him.
Mm.
Maybe you can get him on the Ed Gadfly
Stephanie,
podcast.
You heart Peter Thiel?
I heart him.
Okay. Well, Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with Seton Education Partners.
Thank you.
Not to mention that marriage you mentioned earlier on
Woo-hoo!
The show. Very good. Hope you come back sometime.
Thank you.
Okay. Until next time.
I'm Stephanie Sirocki.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Education Gadfly Show. We're always online at edexcellence.net. Don't forget to sign up for the original Education Gadfly. I am signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.